That's right. Thank you and welcome back. Of course, we salute your generosity that made this program possible all these years. And the generosity of the volunteers out of this listening audience who have also made it possible to translate that generosity into actual help for our military families. We thank our 501c3 partner, the Navy League of San Diego, where we have had a no-overhead operation. You can send your checks there, Navy League of San Diego, and down on the memo line put Homefront San Diego, and that money will go 100% of it to Navy families, to military families in need. Now, let's see, today's report by Volunteer Candace. Hi, Candace.
Hi, Roger. How you feeling?
Well, I'm a little under the weather. Got a cold.
Sounds like you're on the cold medicine.
Yeah, not good.
Not good. I'm sorry to hear that. Hopefully it'll pass soon.
Well, that's what I'm thinking, too. Sometime soon would be good.
Like right now.
Yeah, like the next hour or so.
Yeah.
So who are you thanking today for helping us?
Well, we'd like to thank a couple people. And as you know, we don't actively pursue cash donations. It's just not something the group does. But we can't operate without it. Our families, we need the cash to help our families, so we'd like to thank John Laws. He sent in $1,000, which we really appreciate, and we'd like to thank Mary Rowling. She sent us in $100, and as you know, we use every dollar that goes directly to a family.
Well, 100% of it does. That's exactly right.
Yes, yes. So, and we just appreciate this. Keep those checks
so great
coming in.
Now, we have a story today.
Do a delightful lady. Her name is Marilyn Bucky. I hope I said her last name right. And she is a volunteer with the Scholarship Division of the Navy League. And I think it might be one of those programs that not a lot of people know about. It's an outstanding program to help our military families. And she's come on today to tell us all about it.
Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm delighted you're here. Let's see, were you or your husband the head of the Navy League here a couple of years ago, right?
My husband, he was the president of the Navy League 2 years ago.
That's right, that's right. And this scholarship division, now tell me about this because I'm not really aware of it either.
Well, we have a new program to announce this year. It's the Alexander Krigrola Navy and Marine Corps Dependent Scholarship Program. And it's a program that was set up and created by a charitable donation from a gracious man who had a great vision to help young men and women attend college who might otherwise not have had the opportunity.
Boy, that's just terrific.
It is. His name is Alex Krigrola, and he served in the Navy over 20 years. He retired as an E-7 Chief Petty Officer, and this was the highest enlisted rank in the Navy at that time. He served on 10 different ships and spent nearly 17 years at sea. He had the opportunity to train naval recruits for over 3 years, and in that job he was able to touch the lives of many young men and is continuing that legacy through his scholarship program.
Who's eligible to get the scholarships?
Eligible students must be a dependent child of an active duty, retired, or deceased naval service resident in the state of California. They must show proof of financial need, and they must rank in the top 10% of their senior class. All of this information, Roger, is available at the Navy League website, and they can also download the application and forms there.
And that would be NavyLeague-SD.com.
Yes. Or they can call the Navy League office at 619-230-0301.
230-0301.
Yes.
And so you have to get applications in by March 15th. So this is aimed right at high school graduating seniors.
Yes, it is. And they will receive up to $15,000 per year for tuition, books, and fees for up to 4 years.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Well, it's very good. And we're going to have a wonderful reception on one of our aircraft carriers in May to celebrate this great kickoff for the program. And at that time, we'll honor Alex for his generous contribution and all of the students who received the scholarship awards.
That is just a terrific thing. So, again, more information for high school seniors. This is a college scholarship opportunity if you're the son or daughter of a serving member, a veteran, or what?
They need to be the child of an active duty, retired, or deceased naval service resident in the state of California.
Okay. Is that Navy and Marines?
Navy and Marines.
Okay. So NavyLeague-SD.com.
Yes.
And then the phone number, 619-230-0301.
Yes.
Marilyn, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Appreciate it. Well, listen, Candace, that's a terrific opportunity for some students out there. Now, we're in need today for our military families. What can we do for them today?
Actually, we only have one big need today, and it's a pretty big one. It certainly is very important to our families who don't have a car. We are in dire need of donated cars. And as you know, we don't sell the cars that we receive. They do go directly to a military family. Title gets transferred, keys are given to them. And so I'm just asking the audience, if you have a car that's in good shape, we do have them checked out by budget. And if there are some small repairs that need to be done, we take care of that. But if you have a good running car, to please give us a call. We have several families waiting for cars. We did get quite a few in by before the end of the year, but we couldn't turn them over to the families. They just weren't in good enough shape.
All right, so we need some cars. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're a military family needing help or you'd like to help a military family in any way, including donating cars, here's the phone number. The Homefront San Diego toll-free line is 1-866-424-9467. Again, 866-424-9467. All right, Candace, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Speaking of all that, on this day in history, February 19th, 1945, during World War II, some 30,000 U.S. Marines began landing on Iwo Jima, which took a number of months to wrest control of that island from Japanese forces. On this date in 1878, Thomas Edison received a U.S. patent for, quote, an improvement in phonographic or speaking machines, unquote, leading right to the CD. You know what I'm saying here. And on this date in 1942, President Roosevelt signed an executive order that gave the military the authority to relocate and intern U.S. residents, including citizens of Japanese ancestry. 1-800-600-KOGO, 569-TALK, 569-8255. World news is interesting, and I want to get to that before we're also waiting, obviously, for the Wisconsin numbers to come in, and we'll have that for you. Aztecs are going to take over at 5:30, but we're hoping to have something before, maybe not. Let's see, if they don't close their, they're not going to close the polls until 6 o'clock our time. All right, well, we'll get that tomorrow. We'll have that for you tomorrow. Obviously, throughout the night, Kogo News will have it for you as well. This is a kind of interesting on this day when Fidel Castro has resigned after nearly 50 years of 49 years. He was the president of Cuba without ever being elected. It's something the Clintons would just love to have, you know, be in office for 49 years without being elected. No campaigns, no rivals, no expenditures. Anyway, Raul, his brother, is now taken over. Speculation is they will try to appoint a younger person in due time. But Raul controls the Communist Party. He controls the newspapers. He controls the military. And he is the head of all of that. And the government. And so, you know, the likelihood of that there's going to be a peaceful democratic revolution here is zero. Now, with that in mind, and today I was heartened to hear, and we don't have that table, but I was heartened to hear that, Obama and Hillary both came out and said that they would be in favor of elections in Cuba. We can be in favor of all of that all we want to, but it's not going to happen. The question really is, since Obama's campaign workers in Houston, Texas, had the communist Cuban flag at their headquarters with a picture of Che Guevara, the communist Cuban hero, superimposed on it, hanging on the wall, just what are the roots, if any, of Barack Obama's association with that line of thinking? Well, hello. He's an associate of a Chicago-based Marxist group with access to millions of labor union dollars and connections to expert political consultants. Go back to 1996. He was running for the Illinois State Senate seat. He received the enthusiastic endorsement of the Chicago branch of the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. You know, of course, we've talked about this before, that they have endorsed Bob Filner in all of his races here locally. There are a number of people nationwide who are admitted socialists when you really get down to talking about it. And this group, the Democratic Socialists of America, endorses them. Later, this same group in their newsletter reported that Obama, as state senator, had showed up to eulogize Saul Mendelson, one of the champions of, quote, champions of, quote, Chicago's Democratic left, and a longtime socialist activist. Obama's stint as a community organizer, quote unquote, in Chicago has gotten some attention, but his relationship with the DSA, who groomed and backed him, has been generally ignored. Now, there is a also a video of Obama campaigning openly for socialist Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, U.S. Senator. Sanders, who won his seat in 2006, called Obama, quote, one of the great leaders of the United States Senate, unquote, even though Obama had only been there for 2 years. The National Journal has said that Obama established himself in his career as a United States Senator as, quote, the most liberal senator. Wow, more liberal than Sanders? That's quite a feat. Quite a feat. Now, this brings us to his legislative record, which is very short. But it includes this, the Global Poverty Act. Now, the Global Poverty Act, and here's the number. I was asked in the chat room yesterday about the number of this bill. It's S-2433, S for Senate Bill, S-2433, commits the United States to spend $843 billion in foreign aid over the next 13 years, more than we're spending now, and have the aid given out through the United Nations. So let that sink in for just a minute. The issue of Obama and his ties to pretty radical left-wing folks is something that needs a lot more attention before we are caught up in Obama mania. Now, counterposed to that, front page, Wall Street Journal today, headline, White Man Hold Key for Democrats. Fascinating article. Wait to hear some of this. Let's take a break first at 420 KOGO Wartime and So who holds the whip hand? Who's the decider in this race between Obama and Clinton? According to the Wall Street Journal front page story, White Men Hold Key for Democrats. Contest may hinge on blue-collar vote. Opening for McCain? Question mark. Here's the story in part. Once blue-collar males were the bedrock of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal coalition, they became Reagan Democrats. Bill Clinton won many of them back to the Democratic Party in 1992. 2 years later, they were angry white males, resentful of affirmative action and the women's movement, and helped Republicans capture Congress in 1994. Now, working-class white men make up nearly one-quarter of the electorate. Let me say that again. Working-class white men make up nearly one-quarter of the electorate, outnumbering African-American and Hispanic voters combined. I don't think people often get that idea. Working-class white men are one-quarter of the electorate, outnumbering African-American and Hispanic voters combined. Are they going to vote for Clinton? Many of them are not. Are they going to vote for Obama? Many of them are, but not all. And so it comes down to who is going to be able to grab this important section of the electorate. There's going to be a lot of people, says one of these folks they interviewed, crossing over to the Republicans. However, in the 2006 midterm election, union members and other working-class white men voted for Democratic candidates by a margin of almost 2-1, giving the Democrats back control of Congress. So what do they find out in this article? Well, they found out a couple things. One is that sexism, they say, runs deeper than racism among many men. In other words, the guys are going to give in and vote for Obama, but they ain't going to vote for Clinton. Well, that sounds logical to me. I don't know. It's just, maybe that's just me. 1-800-600-KOGO-569-TALK, 569-8255. Now, when you read, and I have been doing that, the platforms of these candidates, Barack Obama has a 40-page economic program. Not once does it rely upon a private entrepreneur with an idea and a dream to create a product that we all then buy, to create the jobs and the futures of all the people who then work to build that product. Not once. It's all about government programs and job training and subsidies for green-collar jobs and all the rest of that. Unbelievable. And, of course, both of them have very extensive, very detailed plans on health care. You shall get health insurance, or we will take your wages away. We will garnish, this doesn't mean we're going to put some little green stuff on top of your salad, we'll garnish your, your wages. Just a word of caution. And I do this every once in a while. Before you run pell-mell to the siren song of the government is going to take care of it all, if we just vote for them, they'll just take care of health care. U.S. health officials at the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration, evaluated the wrong factory when they were assessing the safety of a Chinese-made drug ingredient that may be the source of problems with a blood thinner. The FDA said they sent a team of inspectors to China to inspect the plant. They went to the wrong plant. Now, you know, I know they all look alike and all that sort of thing, but you know, really, do I want these folks in charge of my health care? I just have grave doubts. Am I out of kilter here? Grave doubts. 1-800-600-KOGO-569-TALK, 569-8255. Back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. John Lott is the author of a book, a seminal book, just an amazing book, the book of the decade so far, of More Guns, Less Crime is the title. It's also the book of freedom. I can't even say the name of his books. Freedomnomics, senior research scientist at the University of Maryland. John Lott, welcome to the program.
Oh, good to talk to you again.
Say, when was that book, More Guns, Less Crime, come out?
Well, the second edition came out in 2000, first edition in 98.
In 98, yeah. Gosh, the time's flying here. John, I have in my hand here a list of, 15, just in the last couple of years, of shootings at mostly universities, in some cases at places of business, where someone just comes in suddenly, randomly, and opens fire. And in the most recent case, of course, 22 people shot at Northern Illinois University with a guy with a shotgun and a handgun, and apparently 54 shots fired or something in what must have been an incredible situation to be anywhere near. What's your take on this situation? What's the best way for parents and grandparents of college students that are listening right now, what would be the best way to prevent, to combat, to do something about this kind of horrific event, because it's happening all too frequently?
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people who have been at these different events, and it's hard to imagine the terror that people face when they're helplessly having to face some type of killer there. You see stories, or you talk to people about stories about people kind of fruitlessly swinging chairs or something to try to stop the person, or just trying to flee helplessly from the attack. And so it's understandable why these get the attention that they do. But I think one place to start with this is trying to look at the common features of these attacks. And what you find over and over again, and I guess I wish the media would begin to focus on somewhat, is one common factor in all these attacks involving more than a few people being killed is that they occur in gun-free zones, places where we forbid people from having guns. And I understand the desire to try to do that. We think if we just ban guns from certain areas, that's one sure way of making things safer. But unfortunately, I think what happens is that you have to, and this is true with many types of gun control laws, you have to ask who's most likely to obey the rule. And what you find is it's usually the most law-abiding good citizens who obey them, and not the criminals. And that rather than making things safe for victims, what I think you unintentionally end up doing is making it safe for the attacker, that they have less to worry about. That, I suppose the best way to think about this is if you were really being stalked or threatened, you or your family, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your house that said, this house is a gun-free zone? My guess is most people who would think about that would think that's probably not the best use of their time, because what it's telling the attacker is that they have little to worry about if they go and actually try to attack somebody there. And so you look across these states, whether it's Virginia or, you know, mall shootings or whatever in places like Nebraska or Utah, where in virtually any place in the state, people are allowed to carry permanently concealed handguns with them except for a few designated gun-free zones. And for some reason, these attacks keep on occurring overwhelmingly, except for when you're talking about a couple people being hurt in these things, in places where guns are completely forbidden. And I think what they actually turn into is magnets for where these attacks are going to occur.
John Lott with us now. Interestingly, of course, the media went the other way. Chicago, Associated Press reporting that Illinois lawmakers did pass a law saying that anyone with a history of mental illness would be make it harder for them to buy guns. This fellow, this 27-year-old grad student, apparently was had a background of a mental illness, but the law doesn't go into effect till June. So they were basically blaming this law, further controlling anybody's access to guns as the reason. If this guy hadn't been able to get a gun, he wouldn't have done what he did.
I mean, I like to think that background checks are going to be some magic bullet. I mean, I have no problem with them, but I think it's misplaced faith if you think that that's going to make a big difference. There's been lots of academic studies that have looked at background checks in many different ways. And I don't know of one academic study by either economists or criminologists that have found that they've been successful in reducing violent crime in any way. When somebody's planning on committing these types of crimes, and they often do well in advance, going and requiring a background check, even if it was somebody that would have been on a list that would have forbidden them from getting it, doesn't seem to stop them from being able to get the weapons. And you know, people often think about this as an American phenomenon, but it's not. You have many attacks, in fact, attacks that occur almost as frequently, these multiple victim public shootings around the world in places like Europe. If you look at attacks in K-12 schools, the two biggest attacks actually have occurred in the last 6 years in Germany. You had one case where 17 people were killed and another one where 14 people were killed. But you have attacks in countries from Finland. France has had a number of attacks. And you've had attacks in places like England in the 90s in which 36 people were killed, to attacks in the last 5 years in Switzerland in gun-free zones, even in those cases, where it was attacks inside parliament buildings. But the one common factor all these places has been not, you know, a lack of gun control laws, because surely places like Germany and France have a huge number of restrictions on people being able to go and get guns, and they have tests for people's mental state and other things that you have to go through. It takes a year-long process in Germany before you're eligible to be able to go and get a gun. And yet those types of restrictions haven't been successful in stopping, as I say, the most deadly school shootings involving K-12 shootings that have occurred in Germany.
John Lott with us now. The Southern Illinois University public safety chief said that the shooting, of course, was horrific, but nearly, as he put it, nearly impossible to anticipate. In other words, here's a security official saying, please don't count on us. We simply have no way of reacting to something that's going to happen that fast. And so a push is underway. Now, I read this in USA Today. A push is underway to permit guns on campus. A small but growing movement has been underway at universities and state legislatures to allow students, faculty, and staff to carry guns on campus. 12 states are considering bills that would allow people concealed weapons permits to carry guns at public universities. Students for Concealed Carry on Campus, an internet-based organization with 11,000 members in its Facebook group, is calling attention to the issue with a protest April 21 to 25, a week after the one-year anniversary of the shootings at Virginia Tech. So Michael Flitcraft here, 23, a mechanical engineering major at the University of Cincinnati, has a license to carry a gun but is prohibited by his university rules from bringing one onto the campus. He says, quote, the only way to stop a person with a gun is another person with a gun. Do you think that's the answer?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the attacks at Northern Illinois University. They, in that case, the police actually responded extremely quickly. Within 6 minutes, they were there, which is a phenomenally fast response time compared to the rate at which responses normally happen in these situations. But yet, even 6 minutes wasn't fast enough then. And my research that I've done with Bill Landis at the University of Chicago, we looked at all the multiple victim public shootings in the United States from 1977 through 1999. And one of the most important factor, I think probably the most important factor for determining the number of people who are going to be killed or injured in these attacks, is the amount of time that elapses between when the attack starts and someone is able to arrive on the scene there with the gun. The shorter the amount of time, the less damage. And you know, you can have police all over the place. There was police at the city council shooting in Kirkwood, Missouri, that took place just a week and a half ago. But the problem is, when you have uniformed police there, is that the killers in these cases either wait for them to leave or they're the first ones to be taken out. In fact, the police officer who was there in the city council was the first person to be killed by the attacker. The big benefit that you have from concealed handguns is that if you have 50 people or 100 people there, even if there's only a 1% or 2% chance that somebody there has a permanent concealed handgun, the probability is very high that at least someone will, someone who's unknown to the attacker, that the attacker doesn't know who he has to guard himself from that particular person. And it makes it much more difficult and much riskier for the attacker to do that. And in these people's warped minds, you know, law enforcement generally, we punish people after the fact, and it makes it hard for just law enforcement threats generally to stop these people from committing these crimes. But in their warped minds, when you read their diaries or other things, they're trying to commit as much carnage as they can. They want to see, can I go and kill or injure more people than were done in previous attacks? Because they often think that the attention that they're going to get is related to how many people they can kill. If they can kill more people, they're going to get more media attention. They're going to go out with more of a bang. And to the extent that you can limit, in their minds, the amount of damage that they can do, I think you are dissuading many of these people from attacking to begin with. And even if you don't dissuade them from attacking, the fact that somebody's there can end the attack. And the important thing is, we hear, when I listened to the debate over the last week about allowing people to carry concealed handguns, there's so many possibilities about, well, what if? What if this went wrong or something else? We have lots of experience. I don't know. In fact, in the vast majority of cases that people have used permanent concealed handguns to stop attacks, it's not even been necessary for them to fire it. Simply having them point the gun at the attacker has been sufficient to stop the attack.
That happened right here in San Diego, as a matter of fact, at a school.
I don't know of one case where someone who's used a permanent concealed handgun has accidentally shot a bystander. And you know, we have few people know that about a quarter of the public school shootings in the United States have been stopped by citizens with guns before uniformed police were able to arrive. And the reason why they are unlikely to know that, even though the shooting itself gets huge amounts of attention, when it is stopped by a citizen with a gun, only about 1% of the news stories will actually mention that fact. If you look at something like a police officer stopping those attacks, you'll see about 36% of the news stories will mention that's how it got stopped in those cases. You know, I understand the fear that people have for a lot of these things. I've spent my adult life in universities, and I have kids that attend universities, so this is not something that I take lightly in any way.
Yeah.
But you see, time after time, these attacks being stopped in different areas. And it's just not in the United States. Israel just had a situation a couple weeks ago where two Palestinians had gotten IDF, Israeli Defense Force, uniforms and had gone into a school and were stopped by teachers there that had been able to use their guns to stop them before they had been able to kill anybody.
Hmm. All right, John Lott, making the case. I appreciate your being with us again, sir. We'll continue to pursue it. I think it's a big dose of common sense. I appreciate your being with us.
Good to talk to you, Roger.
Thanks, John Lott. I'm Roger Hedgecock. The not-so-subtle push to convince you that higher taxes in California are the, well, they're the only answer to our budget crisis in this state is underway. This from the San Francisco Chronicle today. The no new tax pledge by Sacramento Republicans is getting crazier by the minute, they write. The latest example, the GOP's refusal to close a tax loophole enjoyed by yacht owners. By whacking $1 billion in a hurry-up session to meet a looming $14 billion deficit, the state legislature cuts school child care, teacher training, new judgeships, and welfare. But Republicans in both the Senate and Assembly refuse to soften the damage by fixing a state tax paid on yacht sales. Big boats won out over little kids, more judges, and aid to the poor. Right now, a boat buyer can avoid state sales tax by purchasing the vessel out of state and not bringing it home for 90 days. The proposal was to increase the waiting period to a year, making it harder to avoid paying the tax. The change would have brought the state an estimated $26 million. A fairer yacht tax on the Californians living at the very top of the economic tree is a relatively small sacrifice in these times. Shame on the legislature's Republicans for their refusal to close this indefensible tax loophole. Don't these people remember anything? Remember when there was a luxury tax put on? People who played Monopoly when they were kids, they remembered this luxury tax thing. So they put on a luxury tax in the Clinton years. And the luxury tax went on yachts. Oh, who needs yachts anyway? Yachts are for rich people. They ought to be taxed. And so the rich people can pay taxes. Yeah, except when the tax went in, the rich people stopped buying yachts. The yacht makers in the shipyards who employed blue-collar people to build those yachts laid them off. Thousands of shipyard workers were laid off as a result of the luxury tax. You know what the rich people did? They went and bought their yachts somewhere else. They put them in Bahama. They put them down in the Caribbean somewhere. So this deal where for 90 days you can bring in a yacht into California, this is true of cars too, and not pay the sales tax, well, why should I pay the sales tax here? I didn't buy it here. If you're unhappy about the fact that I'm not buying my yacht in California, then try to think about the fact that maybe your taxes are too high to start with, not too low. Why do you think I'm going to Taiwan to buy my yacht and then putting it in Ensenada for 90 days so that I don't have to pay the 7.78% sales tax because the yacht is $5 to $10 million. 10 million times 7.78 is big money, even for rich people. They'll put it in Ensenada. Now, if you want to make it so that we just don't buy yachts, then fine. Just remember who builds the yachts. Just remember who builds the yachts. It isn't the rich people. Rich people will find some other way to have yachts. The cost of used yachts is going to go way up. But you know what I'm saying? Rich people are not going to pay this tax. I just got to tell you something. I don't own a yacht. I'm not in this category. But I know people who are. And if they cannot avoid this outrageous sales tax we have, one of the highest in the nation, in California, when they buy a big ticket item like that, they won't buy it. They just won't buy it. Do you think their planes, do you think Mrs. Copley's Grumman 4, her G4, which is up in the hangar there at Carlsbad, do you think that plane was bought in California? Hell no, it wasn't. And it was not, and she did not pay income or sales tax on it either. Nobody does that because your damn taxes are too high. We buy stuff out of state. We bring it in. That's what's done by people who don't want to pay this outrageous tax in the first place. Now you want to raise the time you can, the time limit before you can bring it in. Fine. I'll park the G4 in Florida for a year. What's the time limit you want to park it for? I don't care. I'm still not paying your damn tax. That's what's going to happen here. So all this nonsense about how we're going to close the tax loophole and these Republicans, oh, there they go again, just protecting the rich and screwing the poor and cutting teachers' aid and all that stuff. Do you know what? That's just nonsense. It isn't true. Back after this.